You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our questions for episode 40 are, what is justice and what is the ideal type of government? We read Plato's Republic, focusing primarily but not exclusively on books 1, 2, and 4. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer in Madison, Wisconsin.
And this is Wes Allwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
And this is Dylan Casey, also in Madison, Wisconsin.
Woohoo.
But not in the same room.
But not in the same room, indeed.
We would not take advantage of proximity in that way. That would be cheating.
Yes, it would.
Being able to read people's facial expressions, that would make the conversation too rich and exclusive and insider.
I would certainly feel left out. Did you guys hear about this gay girl in Damascus thing? It became a popular blog of a girl who's supposedly gay in Syria, and she was missing, and it was a big deal, and it turns out it's by this guy, 40-year-old guy.
Oh, that's terrible.
Except this guy, his wife happens to be a good old friend of mine.
Really?
Yeah, and I met him a few times.
Did she know about it?
Yeah, and the Post just put up an article, and they've done multiple interviews with him over a few days, and they talk about her, too. It seems a little bit unfair, I don't know, to really drag her into it so much, but my friend Britta.
Is the guy, is it Wiener?
No. Yeah, it's that's right, it turns out it's Wiener. This guy it's interesting. They're both studying Middle East stuff. They're studying in Scotland, but they're doing Middle East studies type stuff, and when I met him, he was driving a cab and writing novels, so... Maybe this will, if this doesn't ruin him, it'll help him get a novel published, maybe, I don't know.
At least get him on TMZ or something, right?
Yeah, that basically it's probably all it's going to do. Yeah.
No, I hadn't heard about that. My initial reaction to hear that it was a hoax is to feel like it's a particularly bad kind of hoax.
Yeah.
Because of the unabashedly serious political undertones.
Yeah, and with what's going on in Syria...
Exactly.
You know, I can see what he started it long before the Syria stuff, right? And so he probably saw it as an experiment, right?
Sure.
To have a persona. He's a fiction writer, so this was an extension of that. And it became popular and people took it seriously, you know. So it's that kind of thing where one thing leads to another. And then you look like a douchebag.
I've actually been doing something similar. I'm David Brooks.
Then you look like a huge douchebag.
I thought your voice sounded familiar on NPR every week with Eugene Robinson.
All right, so how's this related to Plato?
So, did you like reading this book when you were at St. John's, Wes? Was this the seminal experience it was supposed to be?
Well, I was distracted by a lot of other things at that time.
In the fall of your freshman year?
Yeah, I can't even remember, frankly. My experience, you know, I was 17 years old, 22 years ago.
And that was the last time you read the book, right?
Yep.
Until now?
I read sections probably in grad school, and I read secondary literature about it. But as far as plowing through, then I only really got through the first six books this time. I mean, I remember much more reading the symposium because I wrote my senior thesis on that. And when I was a freshman, I think I wasn't that interested. It wasn't really until I was a senior after reading Kant that I returned to Plato and suddenly became really fascinated with Plato. Plato was sort of lost on me early on.
Right, because he just comes off as a jackass, right? I mean, proposing this crazy form of government, like it's very easy to write off if you're not interested in him for the historical value and looking for the subtleties. And
yeah, exactly. This time I was just very, very into it, very pleased with it.
We are lucky to have Dylan here, who has taught it several times recently, right?
Yeah, I guess the last time I did freshman seminar, it's been a while since I did The Republic. But unlike Wes, when I read it as an undergrad, it was a huge experience for me. I read it in my sophomore year as part of a long course where we spent, I don't know, 6 weeks on it. Mm. And I followed the advice of my professor, which was that I should just blast through it once, then read it again with the class. So I had read it twice by the time I was done with that class. And then I guess I read it two or three times for St. John's. But St. John's, it's all conversations. It's not lecturing or anything like that.
Yeah.
So instead of reading expert secondary literature on it, you got to hear freshmen.
Exactly. They're expert freshmen conversations. I've read very little secondary literature. I did listen to some of the Plato iTunes stuff that Mark had pointed out.
Yes, we'll put some stuff on the blog. So one was Stephen B. Smith, right?
which you should certainly follow Mark's advice and listen to it at double speed, because then it sounds normal.
Yeah, this is a lecturer from Yale who just worships Plato. And it's great to find somebody who's a complete Plato advocate and, in fact, paints him as, no, he's not anti-democracy, and he's not, he's just like the modern thinkers right. of today.
I didn't listen to any of that. I looked at, though, the Stanford Encyclopedia article, Plato's Ethics and Politics in the Republic.
Oh.
It's a long and good overview of all the secondary literature debates, and then with a long bibliography. And I looked a little bit at the Cambridge Companion. I don't really have a high opinion, I think, now of the Cambridge Companions. The articles seem kind of random. I don't know how that's supposed to be the introductory set of secondary readings to something. They just seem to be whoever's the editor. Oh, my friend wrote this, so I'm going to throw that in. And then
they don't have the disposition of an encyclopedia, probably.
Exactly.
Well, I read this for the first time, some part of it, I don't know what part of it, in high school. I had a senior year political philosophy class. We had some Hobbes, we had some Rousseau, and this is what we started off with. So this, in fact, it didn't get me that excited about Plato in particular, although I always liked the style, but it sold me on philosophy, period. It was like, this was my introduction to philosophy, and it is. I'm sure that's the case for a lot of people. This is the big book. Not necessarily the whole thing. I don't know if I ever read the whole thing before this time, frankly. I'm sure I did in some class, but I couldn't tell you. And there were definite parts toward the very end of it where I was very surprised.
You skimmed The Myth of Ur, didn't you?
No, I read the whole damn thing.
You did? Wow.
Yes. It definitely drags in some spots. Even just looking at the beginning, right, I chose 1, 2, and 4 because 3, though interesting, just goes on and on and on and on about a very small amount of material about how do we train the guardian class? Should we let them learn minor chords or not?
I thought that would interest you.
It doesn't need to be.
The Dorian and the Phrygian.
Yeah, what are the proper non-corrupting chords and scales?
I know that Simon and Garfunkel's Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme song, that's in Dorian. And then I realized that something said that that's actually the reverse. Like the Dorian in ancient Greece is now the Phrygian, and the Phrygian is the Dorian. So the Dorian is the mode that he was recommending as sort of the martial military influence, right, for the guardians or the auxiliaries. And then the Phrygian was the more peaceful. But in today's terms, it would be listen to some Simon and Garfunkel to chill out, and then listen to Bruckner, I think, is a lot of that's in Phrygian.
So that little random bit from the middle of number 3 is the perfect introduction to people who have never even heard of this dialogue and don't know what it's about. So let's give the 2-second overview. I gave what the questions are. So it just starts as a dialogue about what is justice, and they go through a lot of options. And then eventually he says, Socrates, speaking for Plato, says, instead of considering justice in the individual, let's make it easier to see by talking about it in the state. And he goes on to describe for a long, 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 long time what the ideal state would be, the ideal type of government. And eventually he tracks back to making the analogy, and it comes down to something of each type of person keeps to doing what they do best, and so the state needs to be ruled by those who are most competent and most wise and most in touch with virtue, whereas the people who are dominated by desire should be carefully kept in check. And so that's the analogy for what justice is in the human being, is keeping the parts of your personality in check, of keeping your reason in control, as opposed to your fiery spirit that has its place and has its purpose, but needs to be controlled, and your animal desires that themselves need to be even more heavily controlled.
Animal desires. You really did read the
the Three Horses.
The older translation, didn't you?
I'm paraphrasing. I don't know.
That sounds right. You know, in some ways, since we suggested that we read books 1, 2, and 4, it might be worthwhile talking a little bit in particular about book 1, both because it's fairly long and it really sets things up for later on. I know that the next big transition then, of course, is to say, well, we're going to look at justice by drawing a correspondence between the justice in the city and the justice in the soul of the person. And that's worth talking about, that move by itself a bit. But maybe we could go through the cast of characters or something a little bit in book 1 and what they end up talking about.
Sure.
Yeah.
If you want details, that Stephen B. Smith lecture, he really goes...
He does go through book 1 in detail.
He is excited about, about like what each of these interlocutors... Because usually in one of these dialogues, it's
Socrates and somebody else, and it's the person who it's named for. So you could name this whole thing the Glaucon, because most of it he's talking to Glaucon, who is actually, I guess in real life, one of the brothers of Plato.
Yep.
But in book one, Glaucon is not even talking yet. This is some other guys. Right. Socrates gets roped into first talking to this old guy who kind of is a rich guy that runs the house that he's at. And they're trying to figure out what is justice. Cephalus is the first guy. And his definition is speaking the truth and giving back what one takes. Right. Paying what you owe. That's what justice is. And he's
paying
supposed
your debts.
To. Yes. Mm-hmm. And according to Smith, he represents the conventional view, which is considered and then hastily discarded. And this character, in fact, leaves. And is not heard from again. But he seems a nice enough guy.
Yeah, he goes off to tend to the sacrifices. And
as Smith says, he's sort of the quintessential patriarch.
Yeah.
I think of him as Marlon Brando in the later years. The Island of Dr. Moreau, where Marlon Brando is carried in on this throne with these white linen sheets billowing in the wind. That's Cephalus.
Cephalus, okay.
It could be Cephalus.
You can, yeah.
I thought it was Polemarchus, not Polemarchus. They seem to call him Polemarchus.
The Smith lecture?
Yeah. I always called him Polemarchus, but I could be wrong. Yeah, I never stressed the R.
So,
anyway.
Without being distracted.
We could go to the ancient Greek and look that up.
Yes, we could.
We want this to be listenable.
I have to say it's probably Polemarchus.
Polemarchus. It probably is Polemarchus.
Because the R is long, and then you can't go to the antepenultimate with the accent when the, when
you're
the penultimate
probably
is long.
Are you trying to get me to edit this out?
Just giving you some things to edit out, Mark. I'm just... I actually spent a summer just concentrating on pronunciation of ancient Greek. It's pretty sad, I know.
So this is speaking the truth and giving back what one takes. Hey, Cephalus, what about if some crazy guy has loaned you his weapon and he's asking for it back and you think it's very likely that he'll kill himself or somebody else if you give it back? Shouldn't you? That shows that your definition, speaking the truth and giving back what it takes, is not all there is to justice. There are exceptions. So that is dispatched quickly.
Yeah, and he also uses the Nazi example, right? This is the first use of the example of Nazis coming to your door looking for Anne Frank and...
Yeah, that
joke really
every conversation of the Republic involves that example. It always does. That and Kant.
Yeah, it's a similar type of objection. You can't just say always pay your debts in the same way that you can't just say you must always tell the truth. Things get complicated.
Right. So we're looking for an exact definition, a set of necessary and sufficient conditions, something like that. And so the mantle is then taken by Polemarchus.
Son of Cephalus.
Yes. Who says eventually justice is helping your friends and harming your enemies.
And this guy, by the way, was killed, right, during the 30 tyrants takeover.
So this character is based on a real person who was killed.
Yes.
And Plato was related to some of these people who took over. There was a democracy, and then the tyrants took over for a while, an oligarchy, and they killed a few people. Socrates himself almost got killed, and then the democracy was restored. So Plato, you know, that's one of the... This talk about whether Plato is an authoritarian or not, he's often accused because of that association with the 30 tyrants, although some will argue that he rejected the 30 tyrants just as much as he was critical of democracy.
Yeah, they'll point to that seventh letter.
Yeah, which is probably forged.
Just to explain a little, and this was the first, on listening to these Smith lectures, the first I heard about these letters supposedly from Plato, and one of them at least reflects back on writing the Republic. And so he wrote the Republic after all this stuff happened with the 30 tyrants, right?
You're saying? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was the evidence to say, really, even though this whole thing sounds very anti-democracy, Lee Smith was saying that, no, this letter, how he was so positive about how bad things went with the 30 tyrants compared to democracy, and the democracy was the golden age, shows that, yes, Plato would like things to improve, and of course... Anybody who's in favor of democracy would rather have the competent people win the elections or somehow get in power. Still, at least, Smith's interpretation was that Plato had the common view today. Democracy is the worst possible form of government, except all the other ones that have been tried. And clearly, he thinks tyranny is terrible from the Republic. He has more nasty things to say about tyranny than he does about democracy. It's not as good as the competent people being in charge. Having the people just by their whims be able to say... To kill all the redheads if they hate them. Whatever, tyranny of the majority.
Well, yeah. The problem is loaded because, of course, we like to think of ourselves as having a democracy.
Right.
And so to have Plato come out against democracy, your professors love saying this, you know, he's coming out against democracy and all of you students are lovers of democracy. So isn't it very provocative for you? But his understanding of what democracy is and the danger is no different than anybody who thought for a second about the problem of majority rule, even in the Founding Fathers.
Right. You know?
And the idea that unchecked rule of the majority can cause problems that are tyrannical is central to even our own version of democracy.
Right.
I don't know much about the roots of the accusations against Plato being pro-tyranny, but his criticism of the problems of democracy, they seem pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Less than the criticisms of democracy is just the picture he paints. You know, the utopia itself can be kind of frightening.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. And I guess there it becomes a whole question of how does that utopia fit in with the dialogue as a whole?
Yeah.
For some people, you can, you know, on the one hand, take it very seriously as explicitly what he means. You could, on the other hand, go a full ironic route and say that he means something completely different than that, or something in between, you know, that it fits in with the dialogue as a whole, what he's trying to somehow educate Glaucon about.
Yeah, it's meant to be a metaphor, right? It's meant to be a way of getting at justice in the soul. And so how seriously we take it, whether it's possible, you know, he's sort of needled by Adamantus and the rest of them about whether this is possible or not, whether this is just sort of a pie in the sky kind of idea, whether it's meant to be taken seriously. And I don't think he gives that direct an answer to that. But yeah, this is one of the big debates in scholarship is whether we see this as a serious political proposal or merely as a metaphor for the soul or somewhere in between.
Yeah.
So yeah, we were introducing these characters.
Paul and Marcus.
Yeah.
Justice is helping your friends and harming your enemies, right? So that's supposed to be better than give to everyone what you owe them. It's give it to everyone what is fitting.
But fitting in a particular way, in which involves the just man harming people, which is where Socrates goes after him on it, right? He brings him around to admitting that in his scenario, on the one hand, it means the just man will harm people. That comes out at the beginning, but then brings him around to the notion that the just man wouldn't do any harm to anybody.
Right, because harming them would make them worse.
Yes, exactly.
And less just, and a just person, yes, wouldn't go around making people less just, which seems like a good critique. Mark, you recently posted on, we both posted a little bit on this Eagleman guy who wrote a neuroscience book called Incognito, and he's arguing for this completely non-punitive criminal justice system. Plato is making the same argument here, that justice is not properly thought of as punitive in any sense.
So if someone is doing unjust things, it's out of a defect on their part. I mean, Eagleman is explicit that there's something wrong with their brains. So if you're punishing them for that, actually, I don't see how that analogy completely works. Because you can't just say, you're making their brains worse. You're not.
Well, he's arguing for rehabilitation. So you want to make the unjust more just by rehabilitative activities, not by sticking them in solitary confinement and turning them into an even worse person.
Mm-hmm.
The reason for putting someone behind bars is either just to make everyone else safe or to reform that person. The idea that there's anything just about the punitive aspect of that, about punishing someone because they're bad, is just a bit of nonsense under that view. So in this case also, you know, we're talking about the just man not inflicting harm on someone. And part of what's at stake here, of course, is the soul of the just man himself, right? Which will turn out to involve this concept of these harmonized parts that fit together in the right way. And so whether or not doing harm, that kind of activity, would unbalance the just person, that will become the primary consideration.
Yeah, and in fact, for Socrates, in this little interaction with Polemarchus, that's really the death blow, the notion that doing harm to one's enemies is actually harmful to the one doing it.
Yeah.
So part of the argument is that it's harmful to the goal involved. But in the end, the real problem is that that's bad for the just man. And part of the way that argument works out is the version of doing good for one's friends and harm to one's enemies turns into I'm moving to the very related one with Thrasymachus, the advantage of the stronger, which is different, but
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the movement through here, so it starts, it's just sort of pay what you owe. And then yeah. with Paul Marcus, it's help your friends and harm your enemies. But then the question is, how do you know that who you think are your friends really are your friends? So it's not help who you think are your friends. It's help the people who are actually helping you. So that morphs very naturally into justice is helping the good, those who are actually good, and harming those who are actually not just seeming to be your enemies, but who are actually bad. Because otherwise, if you're just, even if you're helping your true friends and harming your enemies, are your enemies
yes.
really actually in themselves bad people? You know, when you're working against their interests, isn't there something messed up about that?
Yeah, if you make mistakes, right, your judgment about who are your enemies and who are your friends could be wrong.
Right. In fact, the way Plato wants to analyze it is that anybody that's doing bad things is not your friend, even if you have a history with them.
Yep.
And anybody, conversely, then, who is doing good things, maybe historically this person has been your enemy, but it shouldn't be. That's what being the just person is recognizing those things and helping the causes that should be helped, not out of just the random situations of your circumstance and who you happen to be friends with, but through a rational analysis of what's going on. Forwarding the good. Throughout here, this, I don't know, what do you call it, one-dimensionality in good and evil. Even though he doesn't, you know, you might say evil is not the term that you'd want to use here, but it always turns out that excellence in anything turns out to be part of the good, to contribute to justice, right? It's not the case that you could have, like for Nietzsche, say, you have all these different urges pulling you in different directions and sort of each one of them is an excellence, but yet they all contradict. There's no contradiction in the good, according to Plato.
I think this question is related to it, and I'm just want to pick a particular section where this happens. It's at 335C.
Okay.
It's at the end of where Socrates is talking to Polemarchus, where he starts talking about dogs and horses and horsemanship and stuff like that. And he says right at 335B, is it then the part of a just man to injure any human being whatsoever? Polemarchus replies, certainly, bad men and enemies ought to be injured. And then he does the thing with the horses. He says, do horses that have been injured become better or worse? Worse, with respect to the virtue of dogs or with respect to that of horses. And he says, are men skilled in horsemanship able to make men incompetent riders by horsemanship? And Polemarchus says that can't be. And when I was reading this again, I wondered if that was actually just not true.
So if you could teach somebody bad habits on purpose?
Well, yeah, that the way you would make a person incompetent in horsemanship was through horsemanship. Now, Plato would probably say, or Socrates, but surely that would be through bad horsemanship. But it's not clear that the teaching of horsemanship is the same as horsemanship. So there would be a distinction between those two things. And it's also not clear to me that even if you were to teach bad or good horsemanship, that it wouldn't be through horsemanship itself that you wouldn't do both of those things.
Right. This is getting exactly at, you know, so horsemanship is an excellence, so therefore, yes, a priori in that very field of horsemanship, no wrong could come out of it.
Yes, and when I read that, it made me remember or realize in a way that I hadn't realized before how sort of mathematical and geometrical this is for Plato. I mean, there's a real reason why you have to be educated in the geometrical before going to Plato's Academy. And it's because of this kind of thinking about the way one thing is, and that's the way it is, insofar as it is that way. This kind of argument is such a geometrical proof kind of argument that relies on there being no, how did you say it, Mark? You contrasted the understanding of the good in Plato with the understanding of the good in Nietzsche. You would have multiple goods in Nietzsche.
Multiple and potentially incompatible.
Multiple, yes. Potentially incompatible. And I think you're right, for Plato, they just simply aren't incompatible. So when you do things that are wrong in Plato, you can never do something for the sake of it being bad. It might be bad, but the only way you do that is by mistaking what the good is. And once you got what was good, you would never be mistaken about that, or you would never be at war with it the way you pointed out you could be in Nietzsche. You could have wars between goods. You would never have multiple geometries that were themselves not consistent with one another.
Right, I want to read a little more of the passage you were looking at. So he's talking about the different kinds of excellence, right?
Yeah.
A dog has a certain kind of excellence. What makes a great kind of dog? What makes a great kind of horse? This should sound very familiar to anybody that's listened to our Aristotle on Virtue Ethics episode long ago. So he continues at 335C, should we not assert the same of human beings, that when they are harmed, they become worse with respect to human virtue? Well, certainly. But isn't justice human virtue? That's also necessary. Then, my friend, human beings who have been harmed necessarily become more unjust. It seems so. I mean, just listen to really, human beings who are harmed necessarily become more unjust. That seems extremely counterintuitive, and it makes me wonder if this is an issue of translation somehow, that this is not just...
Why is that counterintuitive? That people who are abused become poor in character?
Anyone who has harmed becomes more unjust. I mean, we have this vision of the innocent, helpless, but completely virtuous, the child or the saint who walks through the world and injustice is heaped upon the person, but the person maintains that hope and vision and is not harmed by this. I mean, that's at least one of the archetypes that is in Disney movies and things.
Isn't it also an intuition, though, that people's characters are degraded by being harmed? You know, I mean, the prototypical cases of children who have been abused who can become abusers themselves, or they, at very least, they'll have lots of problems with character, which is another way of talking about virtue, the word that Plato's using.
I think Plato would have a lot of difficulty, for instance, if you have an abused kid who yet still looks up to and loves the parent, right, because it's dependent upon the parent. It seems like he'd have trouble getting his head around that. Like, if you're being harmed, then it should, in some sense, be obvious to you that you are harmed, right? Because you are harmed in very obvious ways. You are harmed in every way. And this brings me back to our very first podcast when we covered the apology, and one of his Socrates is about to be condemned to death. And he says, look, I've been accused of corrupting the youth, but really that's not even possible because look, all these youth keep coming to me. They come back to me. They wouldn't be coming back to me and thanking me if they'd been corrupted, because corrupting is bad. You know, again, denying any sort of multidimensional or difference in opinion regarding these different things that, oh, if I'm corrupting you, then I must be corrupting you in a very obvious way.
What are you claiming here?
It seems very intuitively obvious to me that somebody could be corrupted and not realize that, or be corrupted and not have it be, you know, so I'm brought up as a thief. My parents were thieves and they trained me to be a thief. And maybe even I have a loving home that in my thievery that has been brought about to me. And so I become part of the organized crime family here. This would be inconceivable to Socrates, because according to him, if somebody is training me to do something bad, then they are hurting me. And the hurting is going to show up in obvious ways. It's like my very soul and my body are all decaying because of this hurt my soul.
He does talk about the sort of honor among bands of criminals who must behave in an organized way and justly towards each other at some point, right? So you're saying that this is an uncomplex view, Mark?
Well, yeah, I remember him making references. That, I mean, that's his ultimate argument against, one of his arguments against having a society of people who are unjust. There's no way they can cooperate, because unjust means you can't cooperate.
So it seems like there's room for degrees of justice and then those sorts of complications, even though it may look simplistic here, though.
When I read that line, human beings who have been injured necessarily become more unjust, I take him as understanding that injuries lead to that injustice. But you may be mistaken about whether you've been injured or not. There's this whole problem of making mistakes and what kind of recognition there is about the world. I mean, ultimately, that leads to the allegory of the cave and all that business. So it's not the case that you would necessarily recognize being educated improperly.
This is something I would defend, you know, as a general principle. It's not the case that every time someone is harmed or injured, and by the way, injured here means it's something done by another human being unjustly to you.
It does seem, following sort of the geometrical model that Dylan has suggested, so he has this metaphysics that he works up to, and again, it's unclear how seriously to take some of these metaphysical claims. Like, is he just sort of putting a metaphor out there to characterize a principle that's underlying these empirical observations, or is he really saying this is at bottom what reality is metaphysically like, and thus it's going to appear that way on the surface to a greater or lesser extent? And in particular, what I mean to say is that he's got this idea, for instance, of the perfect forms. So that's really what justice is, written into nature, that an excellence is. It's not just like for Aristotle, the excellence of a dog is healthy and hunting well and doing whatever it is we think a dog is supposed to do, or whatever it is, just observing it, it looks like it's supposed to do. But really, there is an ideal dog sort of written into nature that is just like there's an ideal triangle that we can never actually draw because we can't draw lines with no width and with the sides all exactly the same. So comparably, just for everything, there is a perfection to it that it exists in some ideal realm. And whether it's a real metaphysical existence or just this is a phenomenological feature of whenever we think of things, we can always think of what would a better one be? What would a better one be? And what are we doing that? We're referring to some kind of absolute standard that is out there.
His argument is not entirely dependent on that metaphysics, right? Because you can still get a virtue ethics going the more Aristotelian route, which in many ways...
Sure.
You know, the metaphysics comes later in this book, and early on, it's got a very Aristotelian feel to it. So the idea of virtue, right, and this idea of talking about the virtue of dogs, the idea is that for any organism, there's a sort of built-in function. There's organs, and there's all kinds of work and activity going on that this organism does just to maintain itself as such, right? The alternative is dying and immediately decaying, and there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into just being for an organism. So all those functions, and there are many of them, so the idea is that those functions, in a way, tell us that there's this attempt going on to do certain things. And so there's an implicit goal there with those functions. And there's an implicit best way to be for a dog because you just have to look at what all these functions are trying to do. And you can tell when something has failed and when a dog is not being fully a dog or its leg is broken or those sorts of intuitive ideas. So analogously to human beings, there's what it means to be a human being and to be that in the most effectively, essentially. So the idea of justice is important here is because the idea is that the different functioning parts can conflict with each other. I mean, you're right about the whole Nietzsche thing where he's not saying that they inevitably conflict, but they can conflict. So for instance, if the desiring or the appetitive part of the soul takes over and tries to run things, gets in the way of the other parts of the soul. Ideally, right, all those parts of the soul, the spirited, the desiring, and the rational, do their thing, and they don't screw up the functioning of the other parts. And that, ultimately, is what justice turns out to be. I think you can do all of that without the metaphysics, without the saying it's sort of written into an otherworldly idea. Does that make sense?
Well, I'm letting myself be convinced, because I like interpreting Plato better the way you're describing. So just to make the move in here clear, when I came at this text, I came with the prejudice in mind of Plato has this metaphysics that has the forms and has the excellences, and this is just written into nature itself. And you can certainly, this is one of the ways historically it played out, which is why Platonism worked so well with Christianity. Because if you really think that, yes, of course there's an excellence for everything, just the fact that we have different standards, you can extrapolate from good to better to, oh, there must be a best. And there's the ontological argument for the existence of God. And God is the stand-in for all the most excellent everything. And the thing that we're relying on, just like Plato thinks, oh, we're referring back to our implicit knowledge of the forms that we forgot when we were born, or sometimes uses language like that. If you're a Christian or something, you can take that very literally and say that there actually is this metaphysical goodness and that God is communicating through our consciences or through whatever means straight into our brains. And this is how we make transcendent judgments. This is how we can look at any given thing and say this could be better, is because we're implicitly referring to this innate knowledge that we have of the divine. And of course, I have no use for that view. That seems entirely against the tide of history. And so if you can take it the other way and say, just like you're doing, you can make these empirical observations and see teleological systems, and you can even account for apparent conflicts, like by just breaking things into pieces. You know, you don't have to say there's a single excellence for the dog. You could say the dog has a number of different faculties. These things can get misaligned. Most diseases are like the immune system overreacting to something. Say, if you have allergies, it's because your immune system, an excellent thing that's trying to fight disease, is overreacting. So you're being out of balance. It's not that an evil has crept into you that's corrupting you. It's you that's doing it. So you could look at all these different systems, and each of them has their own excellence. But for you overall, or the dog overall, to have its own excellence, it means putting these systems in proper balance. So you could just base that entirely empirically. And then if you do that long enough, you could say, it's as if there's these, if we want to point out that this concept of transcendence is possible just out of nature, right? The fact that we can look at something and think that it's functioning poorly or functioning well, And could it function even better? The fact that that hierarchy comes out of our empirical observations.
Yeah. And this is a difficult question, whether or not we can really look at organisms and get functions out of them and then start making these evaluative judgments.
One thing about the forms is I can't tell when I read Plato if you have to have the forms and this notion of recollection, that those things are somehow instantiated in a kind of real way as existing standards that then we tap into. Certainly you can go that route and interpret them that way. And so the following interpretation might be compatible with it, but not exactly what Plato himself would mean, is that the notion of a form would be just acknowledging the fact that when we think of anything, we have to have something in mind. And that...
I'm just listening to how you phrase that. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the way I would put it, and this might just not be Platonic at the end of the day, is that if you're figuring something out, even if it's hazy, when you start talking about something and trying to speak of justice or whatever, you're going to have a notion of what that means just by merely having thought about it at all. And you might then proceed in a way to try to figure out what it is exactly you mean. And that's something like what Socrates is doing. You know, if you said, well, Socrates is taking our initial opinions, our sort of brute level intuitions or the things that we were brought up with, you know, all the unexamined features of our intellect and starting from those. And then saying that those have some tie to what's actually going on, that there is some real content behind there, and then trying to figure it out by asking these questions.
Yeah.
You could go in the direction that, of course, like he does in the allegory of the cave, and say there is some real thing that you are having a glimpse of when you have something like opinion. You also could understand these forms as being, again, part of the way you have to think about things themselves. And the question would be, and I guess this is where you would try to decide which side Plato would come down on, is whether those forms, those things that you refer to, are malleable in any way, you know, what the status of them is. The very traditional way of, and maybe exactly the right way to understand Plato, is that those things that are reflected in opinion and in individual action are real unchanging things, just like triangles are, and that how every triangle that's drawn or conceived of is merely an image of an actual triangle. The alternative would be that these things that we hold as quote-unquote forms are things that are constantly being worked on and fundamentally malleable. And that might just be not compatible with Plato.
Well, let's think about, so what is Plato really trying to do here through Socrates? We're talking about justice. I mean, the radical view, right, would just be that justice is a fiction and morality is a fiction. These
That's
are things
Thrasymachus
made up, made, exactly. That's the Thrasymachus day. We'll go to that in a second, but I just want to say, what are we trying to do here? We're trying to say, well, there are actually real grounds. There's something about the world which grounds justice. And you could get into the metaphysics or the ontology of that and say, what models are we going to erect in order to try and explain these phenomena? And it may get kind of outlandish. But really, forget it. I don't want to get into all the forms and stuff. It's good to keep in mind that what does the form of the good turn out to be? It turns out to be, and there are lots of arguments about this, but arguably it has something to do with harmony and this idea of consistency that we've been talking about these functioning parts working well together. And this goes, of course, towards all the arguments that we have these days about deriving oughts from is and all that sort of stuff. It's about, can we say that there's something real to these ideas of justice and morality? And we're not just talking about these inbuilt emotions and these fairy tales that we tell ourselves. And I think your best argument has something to do with this idea of harmony and consistency and function and so on and so forth.
But don't you have at least two directions that you can go there? One would be is that that harmony exists in the world in the same way that the resonant points of a flute exist in a flute, such that you blow on it at a certain speed and that flute will resonate, and that that's the way justice is. It exists in the fabric of the universe in that way. That's one alternative. Another would be having more to do with the right arrangement of things such that human beings, for instance, that they flourish. And then you have a discussion about what it means for a human being to flourish. But that kind of justice, that kind of right arrangement, isn't so far off from the notion of harmony that we're talking about here.
Exactly.
But there is a difference with saying it's fundamentally part of the world in the way a resonant flute is, or whether it's part of some notion of flourishing, which is not as clearly part of the makeup of the world exactly.
Yeah.
It may be, I would argue myself, that it's not arbitrary. You know, some notion of flourishing, certainly right. Not arbitrary, but it's not clear that it is absent human judgment.
Right. And so for listeners, just when we talk about flourishing, we mean something like happiness. It's a translation from the Greek eudaimonia.
Yeah.
Something like happiness, but not, the reason why it's not translated as happiness is because you want to get away from the popular conception of happiness. So flourishing might be something that one wouldn't typically think of as happiness. So you might not, many of us might not really know what happiness is. So using the word flourishing is one way of getting at that. And then also getting at the sort of biological aspect of it.
Yeah. Happiness sounds static.
Yes.
Right. I'm happy now. I'm pleasantly at ease. And that's not what he means.
Yeah. It's not just a subjective, how I feel right now, I feel happy. It's more about, this is a well-functioning organism.
Your dynamical state.
Yeah.
To be terribly overwrought about it.
Yeah. It's not broken. It's least broken, let's say. Least conflicted. Firing on all cylinders. That's another way of...
And it's interesting, like the place where you'd be most likely to conceive of there being an excellence that will vary, that will not be set in stone. Because, you know, human nature is human nature. You know, if you're taking an Aristotelian view that there's a certain way of human flourishing, you could at least make an argument that there's something objective about that, that that's not going to be something that changes with historical attitudes. I mean, just being healthy and vibrant and all that is, that's just, but if you consider the aesthetic realm, obviously there are so many kind of different aesthetic goals and visions, and like, where was Picasso going? What would make the ultimate Picasso, the Platonic form of the Picasso painting, as opposed to the Dali painting or the something other? And Plato, in this dialogue, just purposefully debases art so that you're not even applying that sort of logic and consideration to art. Art is, right, it's a copy of a copy. You can listen to our Danto episode if you want to hear more about the nasty things Plato has to say about art, but you don't consider artistic excellence in itself. Insofar as it's useful to Plato, it's only, like we were saying at the beginning of this, that art can make you more likely to be a just and well-balanced and flourishing person. Right. If you're listening to very cheery music that puts you in a good mood to go out there and fight the good fight, then that's good. But if you're listening to this melancholy, if you're listening to The Cure all day, then that's bad. That's going to sap your energy. Yeah. No consideration of the aesthetic ideals in themselves.
And he's not big on sublimation, right? One might ask, not just about the effects of listening to music and experiencing art, but what about sublimating? What about doing it? Many of us today would think that that's really one of the best ways of living or one of the best parts of life. And for Plato, it seems to be much less important. You could call making shoes sublimating, you know, each worker will do his work or her work. But as far as writing stories, if you're a novelist, you're shit out of luck. And you certainly won't be the gay girl in Damascus in Plato's regime.
Let's move forward in the story
to the 14th page.
Thrasymachus, right, who's an older, and I guess he's a philosophy teacher of some sort, right?
He's a sophist. Yeah.
And he takes the view, is repulsed by, I guess the reason that I brought up this whole one-dimensionality, the fact that it seems like, oh, it's just obvious to him that the good is going to show up in nature as reflecting the ultimate good in the forms, because that's the only way that I can charitably interpret him giving such freaking lame arguments in response to some of these points.
Do you think that he gives the same equivalently lame arguments to every interlocutor that he runs into? It seems to me that the way he approaches the different interlocutors varies, and the sophistication of his responses varies based upon interlocutors.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty clear to me that he does it, so that when he drives Cephalus from the room based upon an argument that Glaucon certainly would never have given up on if that was one that he was partisan to.
Yeah, one thing to mention here is these interlocutors are of a higher quality than the typical Platonic dialogue interlocutor. And Thrasymachus, you'd seldom see someone who's so openly irritated and coming out in such strong form, right? But I think you're right. Not all the arguments. I don't see all the arguments as being so bad necessarily, Mark. I mean, maybe we should look at one.
Well, this one to Polemarchus.
I'm not so sure. And normally I fly by these arguments and I think half of them, okay, it's bullshit. And he knows it's bullshit. He's just doing his thing, right? But now that I look at it, so his argument is that you can't make someone a worse horseman by horsemanship. Well, think about what you'd be doing. You could use your knowledge of horsemanship, yes, to make someone worse. But you couldn't function as a horseman, exhibit it, right? Get on your horse and show off and do all those sorts of things. You couldn't make someone a worse horseman in that way. He's sort of highlighting the show versus tell aspect of teaching, where you're influencing people through your actual activity of being something and engaging with them that way, as opposed to just saying, yes, here's how to be a horseman. Don't get on the horse, and, you know, telling them the opposite of what they... You understand what I'm saying?
That wasn't the worst part of the argument that I had been considering. It was all this going through what makes someone a good doctor. The best doctors are also the people that know how to hurt you the most, right? They know about how the body works. Yeah, okay. Then the person who's just is the one who should know how to hurt you and harm you the most, right? By comparison, because he knows how to aid his friends and he also knows how to hurt his enemy. But that just makes being just sound really bad. And that seems to be the counterintuitive point, which the analogy just doesn't work very well. I don't see why he would...
I guess the question is, I mean, at the end, he gets to something that nobody agrees with, right? He gets to saying that the just man, then, it seems to be, has come to light as a kind of robber. And so Socrates, in his typical fashion, says, well, clearly this can't be the case. So maybe we want to change where we started from again. And there's a new version of the argument made. And you're saying, Mark, that you're not even sure that you agree with sort of the way they got to that change, that there's just something problematic about it.
Yes, this argument by analogy, which I know is just a very old argument form that is not accepted in modern, but in our Buddhism podcast, we saw that was actually like an accepted, recognized form, that if you use an analogy, that somehow you've shown something deep and wonderful. And so we have this idea here, saying something like, it's good to help your friends and harm your enemies, saying, oh, that's like saying it's good for a doctor to help people and hurt people. But no, we wouldn't want them to do that. That's not what being a doctor is. So being just can't involve the hurting. Like, it's sort of using this emotional connection to just put it in a bad light. It's appealing to this underlying intuition of this single dimensionality again of virtue, that you're saying, oh, no, but isn't justice just being good? Just think about it. So your definition of justice, which involves hurting your enemies, well, hurting is bad. And so that can't be what justice is. I mean, it seems like it's that infantile. It's just prejudging the outcome before you even consider the case seriously. And the same thing is done, let's talk about, without dwelling on this one anymore, Thrasymachus's version, because I think the same kind of response is given to him, which is why it's ultimately unsatisfactory. So Thrasymachus, I don't know, we want to read the quote since he's such a good speaker.
He just says justice is the will of stronger.
Right. So in other words, justice is something that rulers in a society make up. And this, again, sounds very like Nietzsche is visiting the past here, that justice is a fiction. Justice is just the rulers trying to control us by saying, oh, yes, it's just to pay your taxes, which go to me. And it's just for you to bow down to me and to keep in your little place, because then I can lord over you.
So really what Thrasymachus is saying is it's a fiction. It's a made up story that the strong used to dominate the weak.
Yeah, and the funny thing about Thrasymachus is that I feel like he doesn't, at the end of the day, give utterly the strongest version of this argument, where he concedes to this version of it that the unjust man is really...
is miserable, right?
The just man is miserable and the unjust man is the happiest. But there's a version of it that it seems like he's saying that Thrasymachus is conceding a notion of justice that is sort of conventional, and using that for those categories of just and unjust.
Yes.
Rather than sticking strongly to the argument that justice is actually a fiction, and that no matter what you call just and unjust, it's always the case that the just is whatever the stronger says it is. You know, for instance, we have Jim Crow laws and stuff like that, and you would say, well, somebody being thrown in jail for drinking water at the wrong water fountain, that's just because, well, that's what the stronger have said. And then eventually it changes and a different group becomes stronger and they say, no, actually, that's not right. We're not going to do it that way. It seems to me the strong version of Thrasymachus' argument would be to say that it's not that it was actually genuinely more just. It's that who was the stronger changed.
Yeah, and I think the heart of his argument, really, right, is that it's better off to be
unjust.
The unjust man. The role it's playing in the dialogue is that he's saying it's you're better off being unjust, and Socrates is now going to have to say why it's better off to be just, and saying why you're better off being just really goes towards the question of what justice is, because it turns out to be this, you know, harmony between the parts.
Yeah, I agree. And that's exactly the way it goes. And I guess what I wondered when I was reading it was, why having the formulation that justice is the will of the stronger requires you to say that the unjust man...
You're better off being
that you're better
the
off
unjust
being
man.
Unjust.
You know, remember, Anthrasymachus calls it sort of naivete to be a just man, and you get taken advantage of, you never get ahead.
There, he's using just and unjust in a kind of conventional way.
Right.
That it doesn't seem to be the same way he's using it, or ought to be using it, when he says justice is the will of the stronger. So that when you say that it's better off to be unjust, I don't know what that means at all, because if you were winning, you're just by definition.
Right. He slips back and forth.
If you are the stronger, whatever you do is just.
Well, but it's saying that the rulers make rules for everybody else. And for the ruled to obey is, according to these rules, just.
Right.
But the ruler himself does not obey the rules. The ruler is unjust according to his own standard that he has set up for everyone else.
Okay.
Because it does not apply to the ruler. And so for him to appear to be the embodiment of the rules he's created, to have the moral ideal that he's set up, which is really meant to oppress other people, but in fact, to be exactly the opposite of that, that's the best, is what Thrasymachus is saying.
That makes sense in that way. Saying that it's best to be unjust, it means that it's best to not have to follow the rules that one makes for everyone else. And that's what you mean by being unjust.
But it's true, though, that the way that is stated does not give room for transcendence or improvement, right? And the initial thing that Socrates says to respond to Thrasymachus is, can't the rulers be wrong about their interest?
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
I mean, it's really supposed to be that the rulers have got these laws that will oppress everybody else and elevate them. What if they're wrong? Then justice, according to the ruler's own standard, should be the rules that they should, that would maximally oppress everybody and lift them up, but not actually what they determine, because they are not omniscient with regard to the strategy for best doing this. So right there, he's saying it can't, and this is just the pattern throughout. It's not just that morality, that justice has to just be whatever society says it is, or whatever these rulers say it is, or something, because there's always room when we analyze the logic of why this rule was set up to improve it, to make it more accord with that logic, which that in itself is not to concede that Socrates is right, that all these forms of improvement are all one-dimensional, going toward the forms, which is eventually how he wants to rip down Thrasymachus by saying, oh no, if you're going to, you know, improve these rules, then they're going to basically improve in that one-dimensional way so that everybody is more successful, right? Not just that we'll put you on top.
Yeah, so this makes a couple things more clear to me, both about the way the argument with Thrasymachus works, but also the way the book works later on, is just the continual emphasis for Plato and Socrates that the just man, or at least the very least, the just ruler, rules for the sake of the ruled, not for the sake of himself. Mm-hmm. And that goes to the role of education in the book. And that goes towards the understanding of justice as being, you know, Thrasymachus chastises Socrates for not understanding the distinction between the sheep and the shepherd. And Socrates comes back and says, well, but the shepherd doesn't tend the sheep for the sake of himself. The shepherd, properly speaking, tends the sheep for the sake of the sheep.
Which is, again, he's using this argument from analogy, and he uses this in other ways, that a doctor, insofar as there is a doctor, is helping the people, and so a ruler, by analogy, insofar as he's a ruler, is putting the people in line, is not serving himself, even though the doctor might get paid.
Yeah, exactly.
The point of medicine is not to get paid. The art of medicine is to help the people. And so the sheep and the shepherd thing is Thrasymachus' response, and to say, look, you know, if I'm a good shepherd, it's not because I want to help the sheep. I want to help them enough so that they will be fat and juicy for, you know, me then to sell or eat later. And that's the same thing with what the ruler wants to do, is the ruler wants to keep the people in line so that they'll be able to pay their taxes to him and do him obeisance. He doesn't want to just kill them all. It's not that. There's a certain art to it. And I don't feel like Socrates has a good response to that.
His response is that then he goes on to the factions and quarrels argument, where basically for an organization to be functional, people have to get along, right? So if you have comrades in justice, there still has to be justice among you. And then by analogy, the same thing with a person, so that you really aren't better off being unjust, because being unjust is essentially being dysfunctional. And that's where, again, we'll get into the parts of the soul and all that that come later. But, you know, he's setting all that up.
Right. He doesn't fully respond to this until the end of the book, until he really lays out those different types of personalities. And that if you are a dictator, then you end up having the kind of personality itself that is just completely at war with itself.
Yeah.
And pretty much if you're obnoxious to everybody, then you're going to be psycho. You can't be a pleasant, at peace with yourself kind of person who is at the same time abusing everybody around you. Which maybe means that Thrasymachus should not have argued that the happiest person is someone who's totally unjust, but who appears totally just.
Yep.
Like, that would be hard. Or maybe is that Glaucon's formulation later?
By the way, this whole factions idea within the soul is early on as well. So that's at 352A. You know, he elaborates on that later on in the book. So, you know, he says, and then when it is in one man, I suppose, it will do the same thing. He's talking about injustice. It will do the same thing it actually accomplishes. For it will make him unable to act because he is at faction and not of one mind with himself. And second, an enemy both to himself and to just men. So this idea of dysfunction comes along very early.
Right. Well, so maybe the Thrasymachus response to that should be not that it's best to be perfectly unjust, but that it's better to be less just than the people that you are ruling. That you want the people you are ruling to keep in line and obey your orders and give you all the tribute and things. And you want to have a good reputation and look good, but you want to be unjust enough so that you can get inordinate amount of good out of the situation, inordinate amount of benefit, you know, financial and otherwise, out of the situation, but not so bad that you'll be dysfunctional and not have underlings that can get along with you.
Or you would question the relationship between your harmonizing with others and your inner harmony, let's say. So you'd question the relationship between psychological inner conflict and engaging in, let's say, sociopathic behavior or in unjust yes. behavior habitually. There are strong arguments to be made on Plato's side there. But Thrasymachus also would have some ammunition there.
So book one comes to a close with, then Thrasymachus, this is a 353E. Will a soul ever accomplish its work well if deprived of its virtue, or is that impossible? Impossible. Then a bad soul necessarily rules and manages badly while a good one does these things well? Necessarily. Didn't we just agree that justice is the virtue of soul and injustice vice? We did so agree. Then the just soul and the just man will have a good life and the unjust man a bad one. It looks like it, he said, according to your argument, etc. So he kind of is browbeaten into going along with it.
Thrasymachus is basically saying, yeah, whatever.
And that's a pretty self-contained dialogue. I guess I read somewhere that some scholars even threw out the idea that this book one is like an old-timey Socrates dialogue, might have even been written separately from the rest. In any case, it ends more like the Meno or one of the other old-timey dialogues ends up. And then book two, though, takes this up again. And Glaucon, this new character who's, again, in real life, one of the brothers of Plato, says, yeah, Socrates, that was a kind of a crummy answer. I think you need to give a...
I think we need 9 more books of this.
Yeah, I think you need to give a more positive defense for why being just should make you happy, right? Not just that a priori, it should, because I have a one-dimensional view of value, and therefore, if you are just, that is the virtue of the soul, and therefore, if you don't have the virtue of the soul, you are non-functioning, and you're not going to be happy. You're going to be wretched. It's a very a priori argument.
Ultimately, the task that Glaucon says for Socrates is pretty interesting, to show that the just man, who is universally perceived to be completely unjust and suffer terribly the consequences of that, but yet be actually just, that man lives a happier life.
Right, and we should point out this example of the Ring of Gyges.
Yeah, that's in book two.
Yes, a guy that has a ring that can make himself invisible. Yep. And come on, wouldn't that be cool? And wouldn't you go and just do anything you wanted and be the most unjust son of a bitch that you could because there'd be no consequences? Come on. I mean, this is a direct appeal to your own intuitions, a semi-phenomenological argument there based on this story of a guy who had such a ring and toppled the king and married his wife. So it's nice that such a little sci-fi fantasy example goes all the way back here.
Yeah, Hollow Man, right?
Exactly. Or would you take the ring and put it on your mantelpiece like Bilbo and never use it again, except to avoid unpleasant callers? We've already set up what Socrates' response to this is. Well, really, to see why injustice is so bad, we need to talk about what would make for a just society versus an unjust society.
But it's important to remind ourselves that the reason that we go to the just society is as a way to look at the soul, the individual, right?
Right. So why does being just make us happy? Well, let's look at a more obvious example, because the city is bigger and bigger is more obvious.
Might not be altogether clear that the best city is arranged in the same way that the best soul is.
No, in fact, and it's put forward, I think, very hypothetically. Mm-hmm. Like, let's just see if, you know, it's kind of like using a microscope that we can see this by looking at this big thing. Let's just see if this analogy works.
Yeah.
Right. And then he says, we'll start with the city and then we'll move on to the soul and...
Which he never does.
Find comparison. So it's an open question.
Well... Other than he has this principle that he appeals to a couple times that, like, if it looks like something's conflicted, if it looks like it's pushing in two directions at once, there must be two different parts in it that are pushing in two different directions.
Right.
Like, that's just how physical things work. If you look at machines or things you find in nature. And so if we find that we have at least three urges, so we have reason, our rational faculties pulling us in one direction and our spirit pulling us into another. And then it's not even that desire pulls in a third direction. Desire pulls in all sorts of different conflicting directions. So he has this image later of a person being a combination of, has one head that's a man and one head that's a wolf.
One that's a lion for the spirit.
Right. Sorry. One that's a lion, not a wolf. And then one that's like a many-headed, hideous monster.
We should say what spirit is, since that's not an obvious part, which basically is a desire for honor or recognition. And then these parts of the soul actually line up pretty well with Freud's tripartite division of the psyche. So the reason is something like the ego making rational decisions, let's say, and then the libido goes along with appetite. And then for recognition, it's, I always think of superego or ego ideal. So the idea is that this part of the soul is a desire, you know, towards the end of the book, desire ends up in all parts of the soul, right? There's a desire to the rational part too. So the desire for the spirited part of the soul, instead of being directed at food and drink, it's directed at the recognition of others or even the desire of others. And this is where you could think about Hegel and self-consciousness as well. So I just wanted to make those connections.
Yeah. And in fact, even just through book four, he hasn't even distinguished between the guardians, right? The warriors who are going to be in a way in charge of the city. They're responsible for guarding the city as opposed to all the merchants and stuff who just do their jobs and are the subjects. And the actual architects, the rulers, the philosopher kings, right? He doesn't even, I think that's book five or book six before he explicitly makes that distinction. But early on in these books, as far as we were focusing on, is just making the distinction, which is still against democracy, between people who do not have self-control and let themselves run willy-nilly. And that's like the parts of our soul that do that, our desires, and the parts that are more competent and more on top of things and really more worthy, have a clearer view of the forms, have all that kind of stuff. And those are the ones that should, in some sense, be in charge. And even when he's describing the guardians, he's describing them as, look, we can't just let anybody be a guardian. We have to have a certain kind of person who is trained for this. We can't just have shoemakers fighting our wars. We'll have a terrible stinking army. We need to have specialists about this. And so it really becomes, for this is book three and book four, what would make this kind of virtuous person, this kind of guardian who is going to not just be able to fight, because you could just be a brute and know how to fight, but is going to have this sense of honor, like the lion as you're describing it, and be willing to make the sacrifices for the city that are necessary, because that's what any ruler is really going to have to do. Anybody that's not just being managed, anybody that's not the sheep is going to have to be paying attention to the art of ruling or the art of being a guardian in this case.
Yeah, and we should keep in mind that the guardians start out as just the military force, and then later on he divides them into the guardian rulers who will be end up being the philosopher kings, and then the auxiliaries who will be the military force, which is interesting in and of itself, just that genesis. It's really counterintuitive that the subset of the military force protecting the city are going to end up as the hyper-rational rulers, right? It's strange.
I guess that doesn't surprise me, because again, this sort of one-dimensional nature of virtue. So the idea of philosopher king sounds insane to people because they're picturing what professional philosophers are now, which are these people who are caricatured as neglecting the rest of their lives and having their heads in the clouds. And this was even a caricature, of course, that was present in Socrates' own day. This is how he was himself characterized by Aristophanes in that play, The Clouds. Mm-hmm. But no, really, if you're going to be an excellent person, you're going to be an excellent person all around. And so you have to go to gym class as well as to math class. And those are not opposed.
Yeah, Socrates himself was reputed to be a great fighter, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and Plato got his name, supposedly, because that was his wrestling name.
Yep.
So they kicked ass and they're smart. They're basically Navy SEALs.
So this episode is dedicated then to the recently deceased... Was it Randy Savage?
I thought you were going to dedicate it to Bin Laden.
No. No, the wrestler.
There's a new memoir by a Rhodes Scholar who became a Navy SEAL that just came out. Mm.
You know, we had some of this at St. John's.
We had a secret SEAL team.
There was a guy who was a SEAL there. But we had the... Do you still have the Homeric Fitness Club?
No. Yeah. There's a bunch of Johnnies who exercise naked together? Was that the idea?
No. But we did exercise in the mud, and there's this former Marine, this guy named B. Good, Brian Good. Yeah, he did this for years at St. John's. It was very popular. Just like a hardcore CrossFit-style workout before CrossFit became popular.
Can I just pull back to our ideal city?
No. No, you can't, Mark.
What's most counterintuitive to me about this has already been set up in his examples and his analogies in book one, when he's talking about sort of what's the excellence of a particular art form of medicine and things, is when he's considering sort of what's going to make a city, he's going to say, of course, it's more efficient for everybody just to do one thing. You don't want just the shoemakers to be warriors. You want the warriors to be expert warriors. Well, in the same way, the shoemakers should be expert shoemakers. And that means doing nothing else. That means just being a goddamn shoemaker.
Yeah. And having the last name Schumacher.
Yes. And that actually gets raised as a definition of justice somewhere in here, is everybody keeping to their business and doing their individual.
I love that ends up being the answer. Everyone minding their own business. That's justice. But again, it goes to the idea of function and all these divisions within the soul, and each function doing its own thing and not interfering with the other functions, or not trying to do things for which it is ill-suited. So the appetitive part of the soul is not good at ruling. It doesn't lead you in the right direction.
Right. It's perhaps a good argument for this whole talk of the state being merely an analogy, because he's even asked, like, won't the guardians who have this really strict, weird lifestyle be kind of miserable? They don't ask specifically, I think, won't the shoemaker be annoyed at having to just make shoes his entire life and do nothing else?
No, they don't care about those guys.
Yeah, they don't.
But certainly they could ask that question, and won't these people be irritated not having luxuries and things? Everybody's supposed to be living rationally in some way, and won't that be irritating?
Well, no, the guardians live in this austere way, and the craftsmen get to have private property and luxuries and things like that.
But there are limits that what people's desires really want them to have would require a state that is aggressive and is constantly going out and conquering other states, taking their stuff in order to feed the insatiable desires for luxuries. And if all the citizens, I don't know where this is in the text exactly, but if all the citizens just would keep their desires manageable, or, you know, maybe it's just the fact that the philosopher kings are telling them what they can and can't have. They don't have to control themselves at all, but the philosopher kings are keeping them in line and saying, no, we're not going to conquer the other countries so you can have the new Depeche Mode album. I don't know what the luxuries.
There are definitely no Hummers in the Republic.
So. Exactly.
But there's a lot of Priuses, and that's pretty good.
So wouldn't all these people be dissatisfied? And Socrates' response is, this is all about having a state that will stick together, that the state will be overall healthy. It's not about the individual members. They have to kind of subsume themselves to the state. And so you could take that at face value and say, this is his political philosophy. Or you could just say, the only reason he brought this up is because he's doing this as an analogy for the soul. And it's much easier to argue that, you know, your appetitive nature doesn't get to have everything it wants because it is subservient to you. It's your overall health that should be at issue here.
Yeah, there's the complex issue, right, of the relationship between the happiness of the craftsman and then the flourishing of the whole state. But obviously, even if it's just a metaphor, the appetites can't just be shut off, right? They can't just be repressed in this authoritarian way. They have to be given some outlet, some satisfaction.
Being just redirected to your own business. Be the best goddamn shoemaker you can be.
Yeah, sublimation.
Get all your joy out of your shoemaking, yes.
Yeah, sublimation into work is one form of redirection, but they also have to be given, right? Food and drink and wives to some extent, yeah. And they're not in that whole all the wives are shared in common situation with the guardians. It seems like the guardians have a much trickier setup, I think.
But once you get to be an old guardian, then you get to have sex with any of the others. There are loopholes, right? The way they set it up, that as long as you're...
You're basically like a cult leader, you know. This is like the Branch Davidians.
As long as you're not having sex with people sort of in your own generation or your own Yeah, folks who want more details of the weirdness of the situation, there are plenty of places online where you can get this. So we're not even going to attempt to give most of the details that he throws out there. But he does think that, for instance, among the Guardian class, jealousy would be bad. Just the dynamics that are involved with individual pair bonding would be bad. And also the dynamics involved in being loyal only to your own mother and father. So he thinks that they should all be told the big lie, which is that the earth is their mother and society is their father, something like that. So all the children of a given generation who are guardians are just mixed together and raised communally, which then, therefore, puts some limits on who they can have sex with later, right? Because you don't want actual incest occurring. So I think it ends up being very tightly controlled. So I suggest that we, for the remainder of this, take what he's saying about politics seriously and see whether there's anything good that comes out of that.
Okay.
So, for instance, near the end of book two, I believe, he's discussing getting rid of any storytellers who tell about the gods lying, because gods would not lie. A true lie is hateful to the gods. Lies are only told out of weakness, out of need, and gods do not have these things. So we have to get rid of all irreverent speech, at least in our literature. And I had remembered that, and then I remembered the whole earth is your mother and you're all brothers and sisters. Well, that's the noble lie, and whether there was a conflict there. And I'm satisfied, I guess, just in the way that's described. Well, okay, gods don't need to lie because they don't have needs, but we have needs. We need to condition these guardians the right way. So that's a necessary lie for us. That does seem to belie the one-dimensionality of his ethics, the way I was describing it, because it sounds like the ends justify the means here, right? Which is very much unlike a truly idealistic kind of ethics that says what is good is what is good and what is bad is what is bad, and you don't do bad things to accomplish good. It's 415A. This is in book three. It was indeed appropriate, I said. All the same, hear out the rest of the tale. All you in the city are certainly brothers, we shall say to them in telling the tale. But the god, in fashioning those of you who are competent to rule, mixed gold in at their birth. This is why they are most honored, in auxiliary silver, in iron and bronze, in the farmers and other craftsmen. So because you're all related, although for the most part you'll produce offspring like yourselves, it sometimes happens that a silver child would be born from a golden parent, a golden child from a silver parent, and similarly all the others from each other. Hence the god commands the rulers, first and foremost, to be of nothing such good guardians, and to keep over nothing so careful a watch as the children, seeing which of these metals is mixed into their souls. And if a child of theirs should be born with an admixture of bronze or iron, by no manner or means are they to take pity on it, but shall assign the proper values to its nature, and thrust it out amongst the craftsmen or the farmers. And again, from these men should naturally grow one who has an admixture of gold or silver. They'll honor such ones and lead them up, some to the guardian group, others to the auxiliary, believing that there's an oracle that the city will be destroyed when an iron or bronze man is its guardian.
Yeah, so the idea is to firmly put
the caste system,
the idea of ruling, out of the minds of the craftsmen and farmers.
And how you would tell whether a young child, what they're suited for, is a little puzzling to me.
Overall, the aims of the ruler seem noble, right? So it's not totalitarian in the sense that the rulers are out for themselves and they're trying to amass wealth. But the means, this sort of propaganda, seems totalitarian.
It seems totalitarian insofar as the fact that it's some kind of lie, right?
So just the control. So you're controlling people through these means. We would think of a free and open society. So, I mean, Popper famously wrote this book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, and he took this part of Plato very seriously and made Plato out to be totalitarian.
He admits that the birth of a child of one metal is not directly related to their parents, right? It's not caste in that way, in the sense that it's inherited.
No.
There's, up, right. There's upward mobility.
And downward.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's fundamentally individualistic, right? It optimizes the notion that every individual has their own thing that they are fit to do. What it doesn't allow for is the notion that that might change or that might vary or something like that. But there is the idea that every individual has their own thing that they properly ought to do, and that that is what they ought to be doing as part of the city.
So if we thought that the rulers infallibly knew what people were fit to do, then I suppose you might think that that's fine. That's
would still be a question. Mistakes were ever made.
But in most societies where people are told this is what you're, you know, this went on in the Soviet Union, people were
sure
assigned their professions. we generally think people are more fallible than that. So a lot of this rests on the likelihood that there could be these philosopher kings, these rulers who know what's best. And
that's right. I mean, you know, the whole idea of it being imposed would be the part that you'd react against in terms of being totalitarian or something like that. But how far away is it from the idea that every person ought to find what they most ought to do? There's the distinction between someone saying, that's what you should do because that's the metal of your soul and I know it. But if you take away the part of the guardians telling you that, or say, well, the guardians are always right, then the idea that every person has their own natural thing that they most ought to do seems very much like, you know, the way we talk about things right now. There's nothing in there about you do what you have to do. You do what necessity dictates.
Assumed.
You fulfill your obligation. Here you're fulfilling yourself as an individual, and the only conflict would come is if the guardians are wrong about that. It's so in line with a robust notion of individuality, at least in that way. It's completely at odds with the notion of obligation, except for the philosopher king, who does something that he doesn't want to do, right?
Right. They'd rather not rule. They'd rather not get involved in public life in that way.
Yeah, but they're the only one. Everyone else is doing not only what they ought to do, but at some level, what's most fitting for them. I guess, unless you have some war in your soul, which they don't talk about, that which you're most fitted for is not what you want to do. But that seems to be an unadmitted possibility.
Yeah, suppose you wanted to be a mediocre shoemaker much more than you wanted to be an excellent ironsmith.
Yeah.
A mediocre rock star instead of anything else.
Yeah. There are people who would be happier doing what you love, right?
Yep.
Regardless of whether or not it's going to make you rich and famous or lead to a tremendous amount of success.
The other assumption here seems to be, because remember, the whole thing was set up in the first place of what roles does society need to have filled? And there's an assumption here that if people are pursuing what is right for them, then all those roles will be fulfilled. Whereas that seems entirely counterintuitive to me. Certainly, if you're giving them the ability to identify themselves, you're not going to find enough self-identified ditch diggers to dig all the ditches. There's too many terrible jobs that need to be done. We're not going to have a balanced amount at all unless you have...
You really need a pretty extensive noble life, the ditch diggers. Ditch digging is a wonderful thing.
Well, you just need an extensive slavery system, right?
Or that. But there are no slaves in this, are there?
It's just Plato's assumption that there are enough people that have crude and rude natures, and those people, it's going to be proper for them to be the ditch diggers. And maybe you could even convince them of this, because they'll recognize the crudity and rudeness of their natures. And if they don't, well, then that's the leader's job to let them know that, to not give them a choice in the matter.
I mean, going back to the idea, Mark, that you said, well, let's take the politics seriously. What about the underlying notion that the just society is one that has parts working harmoniously with one another?
Well, let's take the anti-democratic idea, right? So there's no voting here. We have an aristocracy where people who are qualified to make decisions are making them, and the rest of you are shit out of luck.
I think it's very hard for us to separate out what we would predict to be the piss-poor practical implementation of anything like this, based on our historical knowledge of when people have actually tried crap like this, from the value of dreaming up an ideal form of government and seeing what you can get out of that. And actually, that was what was most influential, what was most inspiring when I read this in high school originally was, wow, that should be what everybody does first. Like, even if you can't figure out how to get from point A to point B, what would be just the most awesome way? Okay, so it would be awesome if we only had people in charge who were actually qualified to be in charge. So how could we then take the system that we have now and try to get closer to that? It doesn't mean we necessarily have to take radical measures, and anybody that has pretensions toward leading who's not suited toward it, we have to brand them and call them bronze and demoralize them. Maybe there's a more subtle way to get out of that, but it just becomes a separate issue once you've determined what the ideal is of how best to implement that.
The philosopher kings, I guess you want to call them smart, right? But aren't they really, I guess, wise, for lack of a better term?
Yeah.
The way in which they are fit, it's their judgment, right? They're great at judging.
They go through some pretty serious schooling, though, and
yes,
math and philosophy, and then We have been plenty of chances to flunk out along the way. And
exactly.
And then they have to be able to contemplate the good at the end, the hardest thing, the hardest part. So.
Right. So maybe a fairer way, instead of having an IQ test as a prerequisite, which might be successful in cutting off some truly undesirable people to have in public office, would also let in a lot of horrible people. And maybe it should be that there are actual schools of government that offer degree, you know, much like we have law schools.
Smartness is only one part of it. Then we have venality. There are lots of clever but unjust politicians, right, who are just in it for themselves.
The closest thing we have to it is, how do you become a Supreme Court judge? Which, of course, we've already seen how that doesn't work because of the politicization of it. But it's supposed to work, that it's a very difficult thing to, you know, even get through law school, let alone a good law school in the first place. And then to have gotten through all the steps of getting up in different judgeships and have the Bar Association putting a recommendation of you sort of based on peer review, essentially. And that, at least in theory, is supposed to let only qualified people even be considered for this role. Would something like that be desirable for the president or Congress? Or is it just so inherently politicized, no matter how much you try to make it not politicize that kind of process, that it's just never going to work?
Well, we know it doesn't work, right? We already know it doesn't work for judges or any other. Lots of incompetent people in high positions of all sorts, despite all the credentialing agencies. And
isn't the problem there that, at least in America, there's a fundamental disagreement with Plato about the end of government? At least in Plato's ideal state, the end of government is to make good citizens, right?
Yeah.
We don't really believe that in America. That's the end of government.
Right. It's not the government's business to determine what a good citizen amounts to. It's
right.
to run things and keep us from killing each other.
The overriding value is liberty.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we might say something like public education is supposed to, in part, have some role in making good citizens, which will be important for our democracy. The role of government, even good government, is not to make good citizens. And that's directly contradicts what Plato's ideal city is supposed to do.
Certainly. No, I don't think that the exact thing that Plato was espousing is going to be particularly useful to us in its details. But there are elements that we can consider. Would they be a good idea? I mean, his education of the guardians is described here is pretty stringent and obnoxious and involves a lot of lying and censoring. And we would much rather have our students be exposed to all these things and have them make choices themselves, and this belief in the competent judge being the one who has experienced the most. But still, in itself, I guess he's responsible indirectly for why there are colleges at all, for there being a public education system at all. There's something that we buy about this.
One of the assumptions here is that there is a type of social and political arrangement that will lead to these sort of psychologically perfect people. And it may be the case that there is no such arrangement. There may be no upbringing and no social arrangement and no political arrangement that will produce people who aren't fucked up in some ways, no matter how well they approach the ideal of being the just human being. And in that case, none of this works, because you don't get the kind of just people who know best, and you can't ensure any of that, and you really just have to leave it to the type of system we have now.
Don't you buy some sort of hierarchy of needs? Even the people in the most comfortable situations with all the educational advantages are still going to be fucked up in some way, but the way that they're fucked up is in some way better than the way...
Not always.
...that people in miserable situations are fucked up.
In the way that he's talking about, I don't think there's any type of education that ensures that someone doesn't turn out to be completely venal, even if they're very smart and well-educated by our standards.
In support of your point there, again, getting back to Plato's claim that, you know, if you do injustice to someone, that makes them more unjust, like, that was not the picture that came out of, say, John McCain's experience. You know, he was, all this injustice was done to him being put in a camp, and what, he lived there 4 years or something ridiculous like that? If that was true, that all that injustice would make him more unjust, then certainly that's not the way the story was pitched in his campaign.
Wait, but Mark, the claim by Plato is that you don't make somebody just by committing injustice. That's different than saying you definitely make someone more unjust by committing progressive acts of injustice.
Well, he does say that as well, actually. He does say you necessarily make someone unjust by harming them.
Right, because you're going to be filled with bitterness and revenge, and you're going to be a worse person. But that doesn't seem to be the case in this case, you know.
Yeah, we need a more complex account where suffering can also be ennobling. And it's also a matter of the kind of character McCain had before he went in. You know, obviously, He was someone who's not prone to bitterness. So he transcended it, and there had to be something about him going into it that allowed him to do that. And so it only reinforced, let's say, some good character trait that was already there.
And made him more mature and more appreciative and more... There are a nice thing said about a conservative on this podcast.
That's right. We've been getting in trouble a lot for making...
sounding too liberal.
Yes, yes.
All right. It seemed like what was missing from modern political discussions to me when I reflect back on the Republic is a sense of imagination. And I like the idea of coming up with these utopias, even if you don't know how to get from point A to point B, but it lets you very clearly explore what you take to be political values and imaginatively like shake these things out to their logical conclusion. Mm-hmm. And like, well, what society would you end up with this? Is this the best?
You take limiting cases.
To me, that experiment is directly tied to the idea that what your society is like directly affects the way the people are within the society, that your education shapes you. Right.
Which is hard to deny. Even if people are going to ultimately still be fucked up in the, I know Wes was referring to Freud in that comment, but it's hard to deny that people are not going to be better off if they're in a better system.
I agree. So even going that far goes a long way towards Plato's claim that the proper end of a political structure is the good and flourishing of their citizens. And so therefore, in building that society, in building that government, you want one in which you will raise them the best.
You know, a lot rests on the practicality of the control method.
Sure.
So if you think that that just doesn't work practically, that's sort of the argument for the libertarian view, where your best chances for flourishing are to leave it up to...
the 1,000 points of light.
Is to not impose any control. You know, leave it up to localities, states, individuals, whatever.
I mean, there'd be arguments to have about the libertarian view, about whether it, taken as an example, really leads to the highest likelihood of flourishing as opposed to something like the liberal democratic view. I guess my only thought was that just thinking about what the underlying notion of politics here is, that the proper object of the city is to educate the citizens.
Mm-hmm. And then just take the notion of education. I mean, suppose that we thought, okay, let's make our governmental goal education. Let's create the best educational system ever. I'm skeptical about the extent to which that can work, because really education is essentially a much broader idea than what's, say, done in a public school. It's family culture.
That's exactly where Plato goes with it, right? Is that he abolishes the family, he generates a new culture. I mean, he fully understands exactly your point.
Right. To create a republic, you have to go in and expel everyone from the city who's over the age of 10 and
start over
fresh. Yeah.
Yes. And I think he was aware when in describing this, he seems almost joking when he's saying, yes, and people, for instance, the artists who are telling the wrong kind of stories or painting the wrong kinds of picture, we'll just take them to the borders and bid them adieu.
And put a wreath on their head, you know, someone who's a great poet, which is a nice thing to, you know, right? That's a, like giving them a prize. But goodbye. Here's a prize for being the best poet, a wreath and exile.
There's certainly no thought of genocide and destroy anybody that is not.
Although there
in
is talk
with our
of
society.
There is talk of eugenics, though, and the deformed children. And
yes, if a child is born from the wrong matches
among
the guardian class, or
your control would have to be so thoroughgoing if you really wanted to create this ideal political system, which is going to ensure the well-being of its citizens. Your level of control would have to go very deep.
Anyway, I think this kind of dialogue is good and should be ongoing all the time. And I think it's a completely separate issue from considerations of how to implement things. And in fact, a lot of the power of these things is just having a shared vision, right? If we have a shared national vision of everybody being better educated, then that is going to lead people individually to take a more active role in educating their children, you know, even apart from whatever the school systems are going to do. Or, you know, it'll lead people to support more of their tax money going to education than otherwise, etc. I think there are a lot of reasons in it in themselves to be thinking about these ideals in a step specifically removed from the discussion of the implementation, which is something that I don't think our political culture is able to do at this point. Okay, high school is a very protected environment, and there's something pathetic about anybody wanting to go back to high school in any way, of course. But at least in our high school, which was disgustingly well-funded in Northbrook, Illinois, where I went, You know, it had a great drama program and athletics programs, and there was just so much encouragement and choice in pursuing something that you could be good at and fulfilling parts of yourselves in that way, in a way that that's just not in the adult world encouraged really at all. Mm. Like, you're encouraged to be musical and join the orchestra or the band or the choir or whatever, and they'll give you free lessons and they'll put the instrument in your hands and they'll do all this stuff. But once you've graduated, well, you know, if you're not professional quality, then you're pathetic. That's kind of what the culture says. Mm. And there's just something very sad about that.
I agree.
What do we think about his, like you were saying at the beginning, Dylan, that his criticisms of democracy are not really relevant to our kind of democracy? Because in fact, the people writing the Constitution were well aware of Plato's views, or every philosopher like Locke that they had drawn on were well aware of Plato's views. And so, of course, they were worried about the tyranny of the majority already. They were worried about this complaint that Plato has that democracy is just, it's going to have no constancy in its way forward. It's going to do all sorts of unjust things and be completely whimsical and completely disorganized. And that's why we have a republic instead of a democracy.
Yeah, I mean, something like the notion that hybrid forms of anything don't seem to really show up here. To the extent that American liberal democracy is a kind of hybrid of aristocracy and democracy, you know, isn't really admitted as a possibility exactly in the way the republic works.
Right. In a way, the Constitution plays the role of the guardians to some extent, right?
Yeah.
And it plays the role all the more effectively
lie.
Because it's not a human being.
Yeah.
These rules are simply set down and there's all kinds of work done to make Americans revere the Constitution as if it were this sacred text.
But it still seems like what he has to say about democracy. I mean, just the fact that we can vote and inevitably people will vote to lower taxes, lower taxes, lower taxes. But yet they also want all these services that then we can't afford. You know, that's just what people are complaining about in terms of the financial crisis seems built into our form of government. That, of course, all you need is a majority. You don't need a majority that's familiar with the issues at all. And you're going to get politicians that have to pander to this majority. They're not going to stand up and say, no, 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 we have to be fiscally responsible, because the people who say that get beat in elections by the people who just promised the moon.
I mean, the question is this the best of the choice of evils? It's interesting in that seventh letter that we talked about, whoever wrote it, whether Plato or whether it was forged, Plato forswears, he renounces the 30 tyrants, and he says, you know, no political system is any good. It's not just democracy that sucks. Basically, none of the possibilities really work. But the question is democracy the best of a number of different evils, or is there something that's better and practical? Many of these problems that we face today, for instance, I think are pretty easily solved. Healthcare, all that stuff. I think the lack of a solution is really just a measure of appetite, of greed, and all those sorts of things, which Plato warns will screw up your system. What do you do about that?
All right, now say something that sounds nice to the conservatives.
I didn't say conservatives. Said nothing about conservatives.
Well, I mean, the problem of majority rule cuts both ways, right? It just depends on which side, whether you feel like you're on the side that's successfully getting their decisions made or not.
Any closings here?
Yeah.
No.
I'm good.
Next time, we will be talking about Patricia Churchland's Brain Trust, What Neuroscience Tells Us About Morality. Why will we be talking about that? Because we'll have as a guest Patricia Churchland herself, our first bona fide celebrity guest. No offense, Dylan.
None taken.
We will post some videos and other talks that she's given. If you want to hear more about Plato, we'll try to chase down some of the issues that were brought up this evening by posting to partiallyexaminedlife.com. We also have a Facebook group. Go on the iTunes store and give us a good rating. You can hit the donate button and give us some money to help us host these things. You could follow us on Twitter. You could have us send you emails every day. You could set up a shrine to Wes in your downstairs bathroom. Thanks, Dylan, for being with us. Seth will be back at some point. Don't worry. He's not dead. He has not quit. And good night to everybody.
Good night.
Good night. To you.
compromise. It has come in the guise of